Hello, this is your captain speaking. We are going to have a smooth flight. Okay, so if there are any things I should tell you about, please remind me anytime you want. Otherwise, I propose to announce the first lecture. I would like to thank Ruth Williams for accepting our invitation. She will give us an introduction to regular calculus and related topics. Please.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I'm not sure whether I've got enough hands to hold the microphone, but. Some of you may have looked at the outline I produced. I produced the outline before I tried writing the lectures, so I rather suspect that the timing won't correspond exactly. I'll probably spend more than the first lecture trying to give a general background, the general basics of regular calculus. And then after that, I'll talk about regular calculus in two and three dimensions, and also probably three plus one dimensions, and I hope to cover most of that in the second lecture today. And then tomorrow and the day after, I'll talk about four dimensions and about area regular calculus. So I haven't prepared any transparencies because I thought that at a school it might be suitable to actually write things as I say them. So we'll see how it works with these boards. Please tell me if I'm not writing large enough at the back. It's quite possible. So the first part is just basics of the theory. I suppose I better put regular calculus so you know which theory I'm talking about. And I'll start with some motivation. First of all, motivation for looking at discrete gravity, discrete space times. I expect most of you have been to lectures when some motivation for discrete gravity has been given, but let me just go through some of the basic ideas. Can people at the back read this, or is it a bit small? It's okay? Yeah, okay. First of all, the fundamental reason is that many people believe that space-time may actually really be discrete at the smallest scales. When you get to below the Planck scale, it's possible that there is a discrete structure. This fits in with Wheeler's idea of space-time foam, although the main point there was that he was suggesting that at scales smaller than the Planck scale, there would be a sort of granular structure with very large fluctuations in topology. So, the idea there is that space-time may really be discrete at the smallest scales. And then there are some more practical reasons. for considering discrete gravity. Reggie's original motivation, or at least what he wrote in his paper and said at the time, was not actually anything to do with quantum gravity. He was actually trying to produce a scheme which would be useful in numerical relativity. That's not something which one associates with Reggie, but apparently that was one of his thoughts. So it would provide a different scheme from the usual finite difference sort of method that was always used in numerical relativity in the early days. And then another reason, which is a pretty obvious one, is that it... I see people can't read the lower part of the board, can they? I better just write on the higher parts. Raise them up, right. Then I won't be able to reach the top.
There are two big...
Yes, right, okay. another thing is that if you take a discrete approximation, a discrete version, then it reduces the number of variables, usually. It reduces the number of variables to at least to a countable set. Thirdly, if we think about quantum gravity, then it's likely that by having a discrete version, then there will be some cutoff which comes into the theory naturally. Or it may be that the discrete version will provide some other method of renormalizing the theory or regularizing the theory. And then fourthly, because there is discrete work in other areas of physics, in particular in lattice gauge theories, it means that we can actually import some of the techniques that are used in those other areas into looking at quantum gravity. So those are some general reasons for considering a discrete theory. What about Reggie calculus? Why Reggie calculus rather than any other discrete theory? So let's just look what's special about that. I think the strongest reason is that it's actually concerned with the structure of space-time. In that sense, it couldn't be more basic, although I must admit that Reggie often said to me that maybe we should be discretizing group manifolds rather than space-time. But as it was originally formulated, it's certainly concerned with the small-scale structure of space-time. So it's a very geometric sort of theory. Secondly, Reggie's original paper was called General Relativity Without Coordinates, and Reggie calculus is a coordinate independent approach. Which is important because we want our observables to be independent of the coordinate system we use. At the classical level, regicalculus provides a way of solving Einstein's equations for spaces which aren't highly symmetric. We all know that Einstein's equations are very difficult to solve in generality, and usually you have to assume a large amount of symmetry for any system you're investigating. But with regicalculus, you can consider quite unsymmetric solutions because you have a set of blocks with edge lengths, and then you can tweak an edge length here and an edge length there and be far from a symmetric situation. Another point in its favour is that it provides a way of representing complicated topologies, because one can change topologies by identifying faces of simplices which aren't connected before, and so you can get something quite complex. Also, this is one of Reggie's motivations, also the topology one. It helps with the visualization of solutions because it's very geometric. And then finally, although not least important by any means, there's actually a large body of mathematical literature which deals with piecewise linear spaces, piecewise flat spaces, like the theory of intrinsic curvature on polyhedra. And that mathematical body of theory actually provides a rigorous proof of many things that Reggie seemed to know intuitively. I mean, he knew lots of the mathematics. He knows lots of the mathematics too, but he also used his very considerable intuition, and there is mathematical backing for this. So lots of mathematical literature. On piecewise flat spaces. And using that mathematical literature provides a way of relating regicalculus to the continuum, as I'll say a bit more about that later. Now let me give you a very brief history of regicalculus, as it's been around for quite a long time. Reggie's paper appeared in 1961, probably before most people here were even born. And the ideas of Reggie's paper were taken up by John Wheeler and explained in one of the relativity groups and topology tomes. And it was mainly used at that stage for finding classical solutions, sometimes numerical solutions. So at the beginning, it was mainly used classically. Except for one thing which seemed a bit like an isolated singularity. In 1968, Ponzano and Reggie wrote a paper. And that was, the subject of the paper was the asymptotic values of 6J symbols, which are used in calculations in nuclear physics, combining huge numbers of angular momenta and so on. And as a sort of aside in this paper, they pointed out a relationship between a state sum for a triangulated three manifold and the Feynman path integral for three-dimensional gravity using the Reggie action. So that was the first quantum application of Reggie calculus. It's the so-called Ponzano-Reggie model, which is much studied these days. But because it was very specific to three dimensions, it was just ignored for a long time. And in the 70s and 80s, the work in Reggie calculus mainly involved numerical relativity and weak field approximations. Numerical simulations of quantum gravity. Quantum cosmology. Dynamical triangulations. There were a lot of things going on based on Reggie calculus. And some of them were quantum. And then people's attention turned back to the Ponzano-Reggie model when in 1991, the Turiaf-Vero model appeared. And that was a regularized version of the Ponzano-Reggie model. And it's what led to spin foam models. And since then, work has continued on Reggie calculus. But I think it would be fair to say that most of the progress has been made either in dynamical triangulations or spin foam models. And those are both based on Reggie calculus, dynamical triangulations uses the Reggie action, and spin foam models, as I said, grew out of the Turiaf-Vero model and the Ponzano-Reggie model. but you'll be hearing about those in other lectures, so I won't say any more about those. Notes now. oh, thank you. Suddenly seem to go on to page 18. So let me talk now about essentials of the theory. I expect most people here have some vague idea, at least, of what regicalculus is about. The basic idea is to stop thinking about space times or spaces in which the curvature is distributed continuously, but imagine the case where the curvature is restricted to certain subspaces, and in particular the subspaces of codimension 2. So that's the essential idea. And I will give a sort of prescription for regicalculus and talk in a rather heuristic way about how we describe that curvature, and then I'll say a bit more how one would look at it from a more mathematical point of view. So what we're going to do is, I'll talk about n dimensions now, just to be general. We'll take a collection of n simplices. So these are generalizations of triangles, tetrahedra, to higher dimensions. The point about simplices, we want to use those rather than using generalizations of cubes and so on. If you specify all the edge lengths of a simplex, then its shape is uniquely determined. You can't sort of move it around, squeeze it, and elongate it or anything. And these n simplices will be flat. Space or the space-time inside them is flat. And we glue them together. What that means is that we identify their flat n minus one dimensional faces. And then, as I've indicated up here, the curvature is going to lie on the n minus two dimensional simplices. And these n minus two dimensional simplices are known as hinges, or they're sometimes known as bones. I already talked about skeletons with bones. I'll probably use the word hinge rather than the word bone. Now, why does it make sense to consider the curvature on these n minus two dimensional simplices? Well, it's easiest to see what's happening if we start in two dimensions and then work up. And we're going to use the idea that something is flat if it can be projected onto a flat space without any distortion or gaps or overlap. So no curvature of projection onto flat space. Produces no distortion, gaps, etc. So in two dimensions, we can think about a geodesic dome, which you've probably all seen. You can imagine some hemisphere or something like a hemisphere, which is constructed out of flat triangles. and we ask where the curvature is on this. I mean, each of these triangles is flat, but overall, it can, this network can approximate a curved surface, so there must be some curvature somewhere. Now, if we take the triangles meeting at a particular point, let's take this point P, and let's flatten those triangles, project them onto a flat plane. How many have I got there? Six triangles. So seven, thank you. One, two, three, four, five, whoops, six, seven. Not a very good picture, but anyway, you'll get the message. Now, there is lots of distortion here, but imagine there isn't. there's no distortion at the triangles themselves are flat. You can flatten the space around the edges onto a plane without producing any distortion. And so the only place where you get distortion is as a result of what happens at the vertex. And this angle here, we might have a gap or we might have an overlap, and we call that the deficit angle, epsilon. So there's no curvature on triangles or at edges, only at vertices. And this epsilon is very easy to define. Deficit angle epsilon is just given by 2 pi minus the sum of all these angles meeting, of the triangles meeting here. So it's 2 pi minus the sum of the vertex angles at P. Obviously, if those angles add up to 2 pi, then the space is flat there. If they add up to something very much less than 2 pi, then it's going to be very spiky at that point P, and so the deficit angle will be large. If they add up to more than 2 pi, then the deficit angle will be negative. That's also possible. That corresponds to negative curvature. So this is a measure of the curvature at P. And then if we extend to higher dimensions, 3 dimensions, what we would have there would be a network of flat tetrahedra. And if you think about a number of tetrahedra meeting along an edge, let's suppose that the edge is going into the board, and you've got various tetrahedra meeting here. Then if you've got flat space, then they'll fit together exactly. But in general, the space won't be flat. And the deficit angle here will be epsilon is 2 pi minus the sum of the dihedral angles at the edge. The curvature in this case is at the one-dimensional subspace is the edges. So this is an edge, cross-section of an edge. And then in 4 dimensions, we have flat 4 simplices, and their curvature will be on the 2-dimensional subspaces, the triangles. So we'll have to work out dihedral angles of simplices at triangles. So that will mean working out angles between tetrahedral faces of the simplices at the particular triangle we're looking at. Epsilon can be very large. Well, wait a minute. If the curvature is very high, epsilon will be large. So that means that these angles are small. If the curvature is very large and negative, epsilon can become very large and negative because these angles can add up to a lot more than 2 pi. But I'll say something more now about the relation between epsilon and the curvature. Well, there are relations between angles at vertices and so on. I mean, you can calculate that, but it's not relevant to this. Yes, but you don't think about those.
You don't need to think
about
them.
Yeah. So in 4 dimensions, flat 4 simplices, and we have the curvature at the triangles. Now let me say, sort of go through this again, but saying it from a more mathematical point of view. In his paper, Reggie actually explained the mathematical background in 2 dimensions quite carefully. So it really is worth reading Reggie's paper because there's a lot in it. In 2 dimensions, there's something called the, it's easy to define the Gaussian integral curvature of a triangle. If you have a triangle on a sphere, say, a spherical triangle, or a triangle on a hyperbolic space, be like that. You know that the angles don't necessarily add up to pi. And you can define the Gaussian integral curvature for a triangle by the sum of its angles, alpha plus beta plus gamma minus pi. So obviously that's 0 if we've got a flat triangle. And then the local Gaussian curvature at a point K at point P is defined to be I'll call this thing epsilon t. It's defined to be the limit as the area of the triangle tends to zero of epsilon t over a of t. So what you think of here is that triangle shrinking to a point p, and then you can define the local Gaussian curvature in that way. Now we can define these things for a polyhedron. Imagine some two-dimensional two-dimensional surface in the form of a polyhedron, something like a tetrahedron or something with more faces. So we're assuming this has got flat faces. Then you can see that this local Gaussian curvature is going to be zero if P is not a vertex. And if P is a vertex, then it can be shown that the sum of the internal angles at that vertex is just 2 pi minus this epsilon of t. Maybe I'll call it epsilon v, sorry, for a vertex. And so the total curvature is going to be the sum over the vertices of epsilon, which are vertex. So this is exactly what Reggie was defining in two dimensions for the deficit angle. And by the way, you can show that for a compact finite closed polyhedral manifold, then the total curvature is equal to 2 pi into 2 minus big N, where big N is the genus. And that's just the Gauss-Bonnet formula. Now, in higher dimensions, Reggie talked about epsilon cones. I mean, the idea is that you can define a cone in two dimensions. If you take a metric d rho squared plus rho squared d theta squared, and then you identify through angles 2 pi minus epsilon rather than 2 pi, and then that gives you a cone where the angle around here is 2 pi minus epsilon. And to think about Reggie spaces in higher dimensions than 2, what you can think of is to take the cross product of n minus 2 dimensional flat space with an epsilon cone, and so you would think of having metric which was a sum of n minus 2 dx squared, and then a metric like this with this sort of identification again. And then you would take the interior of the simplices to be flat, and the boundary, as before, the boundary of an n simplex to be decomposable into flat n minus 1 simplices, and then the n minus 2 dimensional simplices would have the geometry of the epsilon cone. And Reggie talked about parallel transport for dimensions higher than 2. So what you would do would be to decompose a general vector into a component parallel to the hinge, and then a component in the perpendicular to the hinge. And then when you do parallel transport, it's only the component of a vector perpendicular to the hinge that gets rotated. Get rotation of component of vector perpendicular to the hinge through an angle which is the deficit angle. And the angle turns out to be an additive function of the loops that you use. So we've got a picture here of a setup where the intrinsic geometry is going to be defined by the way things are connected together, the connection matrix, and the edge lengths. So we've got this picture now, but so far it's got nothing to do with general relativity, so we have to find a way of seeing whether we can make this piecewise linear space into an Einstein space. And we obviously need some variables if we're going to do that. So for our fundamental variables, we're going to use the edge lengths, or even the squares of the edge lengths. And those are analogous to the metric in the continuum because they tell you the distance between any two vertices. So what we're going to do is write down a form for the Einstein action for this discrete space, and then use the principle of stationary action to get some Regi analogues of the Einstein equations. I'm supposed to stop now, aren't I, for questions? Or do you want me to... Should I stop or should I go on a bit? Actually,
yes.
I've got a few more minutes.
Good moment for break.
Okay.